The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Later in the show, Neil hears from local author and writing coach Nikki Valance about November's Novel Writing Month and how children and adults can unleash their creative writing skills. But first, Lydia meets Serena Baker, who works in children and adolescent mental health services in the NHS. Lydia and Serena discuss ADHD diagnosis, at what age, and where to start looking for help. Please be advised that this radio interview may contain discussions related to sensitive topics, including mental health challenges and suicide. Listener discretion is advised, and if you or someone you know is struggling with these issues, please consider seeking support from a mental health professional or a helpline, such as the Samaritans, who can be reached on 116 123.
Now, this week, we're going to touch upon a very important topic when it comes to neurodivergence, and that is ADHD. And I'm really thrilled to be joined by Serena Baker, who's going to talk to us about the subject this evening. Serena, how are you doing? Thanks for joining us on The Parents Show.
Oh, thank you, Lydia. I'm grand to be here and I'm doing good, thank you.
Yeah. Great, great. I've been dying to pick your brain in and around the subject of ADHD. It's a topic we're always coming back to on The Parents Show because I suppose research is always being updated and our world is getting more on top of handling and properly servicing our ADHD community. So it's just brilliant to be talking about it again today. But I'd like to start with you, Serena. Tell us a bit about yourself, what you do and why you're interested in ADHD specifically.
Yes, certainly. So I am a social worker, have been a social worker for many, many years, probably over 20 now. And I currently work for a CAMS team in the NHS. And my interest in ADHD comes very much from a personal perspective. I have two children that have diagnosed with the condition. I probably would get a diagnosis if I went for that assessment myself. I can see it in my family line now really clearly. Now I understand the condition. It explains a lot of my childhood with my father, who would definitely get an ADHD diagnosis. But obviously, bearing in mind his age, he was, you know, misdiagnosed as a naughty child, has had lifelong, I suppose, ramifications from that, I think. So it's something that I very much had a crash course in because my oldest has got severe ADHD. And from a very young age, we were having all sorts of difficulties with, I call them more than children. So everything is more. Like there's difficulties usually with eating. They often have allergies. There are difficulties with sleeping. There's difficulty with relationships with other children. There's difficulties in education. It causes stress in the family network because you'll get really unhelpful advice from other family members about this and that, what you should and shouldn't be doing. And then it can cause a lot of stress in, you know, personal relationships between parents, trying to manage that. So I had a massive crash course because my son was, as I say, quite severe. And so right from preschool, I was constantly being called in. Constantly, and had really unhelpful comments. And being a social worker, and I was being a social worker way before I had children, very aware of childhood development, very aware of the importance of routines and boundaries for children. And my son, for a start, never slept, literally never slept for the first 4.5 years of his life. He was 4.5 when he slept through the night properly, whole night long. And there was a whole load of reasons for that, but ADHD can really impact on sleep. And he had other things as well because he's a more than child. So they, as I say, have other things that go with it. So yeah, so I personally, as a professional, I kept getting told by health visits and everything that I had a nice behaviour problem and just do this and just do that. And I kept going, I'm doing all this. It's not working. We have this lengthy routine. I know the importance of naps. I know the importance of sugar-free diets and blah, 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 blah. And eventually managed because being a social worker and this is where I feel really strongly about it because I'm really fortunate in the sense I did have some professional knowledge and I did have, you know, the ability to communicate and to challenge and I didn't feel embarrassed about that. So with my son, I kept going back to the GP. I didn't think it was ADHD. I had one moment when I started to read about ADHD and I had that horrible sinking feeling because I thought, oh my gosh, this is probably it. Because even as a social worker, we had a morning where we, in our training, and I did a master's from social work. It was a really good university, as in for social work sort of reputation. We had one morning where they covered all the additional needs. and as a social worker. And I know for schools and teachers, you know, they don't get that much more. I know the government recently increased the amount of special educational needs that has to be covered in teacher training, but I still don't think it's going to be anywhere near what they have to deal with. And ADHD, I still don't know what they're being taught and how much they're being taught about really useful strategies. So yeah, so from my point of view, I ended up really insisting after seeing about three different GPs, all of whom said, oh no, it can't be ADHD because, you know, he's, look at him, he's able to sit down and do this puzzle, which again, the thing about an ADHD brain is that if you're interested in something, then you've got the motivation to do it. It's to do with dopamine levels in the brain. We know that children and adults with ADHD have lower dopamine levels. They have lots of their neurotransmitters are functioning at different levels, which is why ADHD medication is so effective. It's not a sedative, it boosts the neurotransmitters that are. But anyway, so he was focused on something, so therefore he was interested in it, and therefore he could focus. But after about the third time, I eventually insisted, because of all the difficulties we're having in lots of different areas, that they finally sent me to a paediatrician. In fact, they sent me to the wrong paediatrician to start with. They sent me to a hospital paediatrician to do, and he met me and went, you don't need me. You need a community paediatrician in the CDC, in the Child Development Centre. So then had another delay of about another 9 months. This story will be familiar to many people, I'm sure. Eventually saw the paediatrician at the Child Development Centre. He said straight away, yes, I can absolutely see ADHD. At that time, the NICE guidance was that you couldn't diagnose until the child was 6 years old, because obviously allowing for developmental kind of catch up for some children and even, you know, I suppose a bit longer for professionals as well to get a sense of a child in school settings and everything. But now it is 5 years old, but at the time it was six. So she said, I can't diagnose him yet, but that is a diagnosis he will be getting in a year's time. But then also queried whether she could also see some autistic traits. And you know, as with both these conditions, they often come hand in hand, or there may be one that is slightly stronger and you get a diagnosis for, but there are traits of the other condition. And a lot of children have both. So yeah, so that's the point where we kind of went, okay. And I started attending Advance, which is our amazing charity in Hertfordshire. One of the many, we have a few. Well, I went to one of their parenting kind of webinars about trainings. Actually, it wasn't a webinar, it was pre-COVID. It was a face-to-face training, old school.
Old school, indeed.
Went to a training about understanding ADHD, where I went, oh my gosh, this is it. You know, this is absolutely what we've been kind of contending with. And then went on their six-week parenting course, which was life-changing for us. It literally was, in that, and they also cover autism and ADHD. And I could see some of the autism side, autistic kind of traits that he had that I hadn't really recognised as being from that place.
Yeah.
And it, for us, it really was. And it was really significant for him, because at that point, you know, he'd been in so many negatives at school already, even such a little age. I remember, unfortunately, the preschool he went at the time, which was actually a lovely preschool, but they still believed in the naughty chair. And he was on the naughty chair so much, he ended up throwing the naughty chair a lot. And he'd had so many sort of negatives already at school, and then unhelpful stuff from other, you know, people who think it's all down to parenting and, you know, he just needs this and he just needs that. That by the time we finally kind of got there and I went on the course, it really helped us understand where some of this challenge was coming from. So we really shifted in how we started parenting him. Not that we've been parenting him badly, but children with neurodiversity or neurodivergence need different parenting. They just need different parents because they have different needs. So that was really significant for him and for us. And then eventually I ended up working for Advance. Eventually, a few years down the line, they asked me to come and work for them. So I became a coach and training for them for quite a few years. But yeah, and then could see it in my youngest from quite a young age. But then I kept kind of going, well, I know a lot of other parents will do, because she wasn't as extreme and she's a girl and ADHD looks very different in girls than it does in boys. I'd be like, oh, it's just learned. She's just copying her brother. It's just this. She's just lively. But always had it in my mind that I could see it. And as she got older, really, it's when it starts to impact on them. That's when you kind of need to do something about it. When you see it starting to impact on their functioning or on their self-esteem or on their ability to learn or their peer friendships, then that's, you know, that's the point. I was like, right, okay, we need to do this. But yeah, so often I think second children, other children in the family can get overlooked, because usually there's one child perhaps that has more obvious needs or is taking a lot of the family attention and energy. And so the amount of families I work with who kind of almost beat themselves up at some point. I'm personally friends that I know as well. It's not just professionally, but personally, you kind of go, oh, I missed it in my youngest, or I missed it in my middle child, because, you know, the youngest or the oldest have been so sort of all consuming. But it's really easy to do, because it mediates differently in every child, because every human being is a unique individual, aren't they? Genetically and personality wise and ability wise. And so it does look very, the same conditions can look incredibly different, even within a family.
And I think there's very little awareness of that, Serena, you know, about the difference in how it presents itself in girls and boys. Could you just give our listeners, you know, maybe a few examples of the difference in how it presents? I know one size doesn't fit all, but yeah, generally, if you can.
I mean, ADHD, I mean, again, I know there's this talk about, certainly in the autistic kind of research and stuff, they talk about female presentation, male presentation in autism. But I think that hasn't always been so helpful, because obviously some boys can, you know, present with a female presentation of autism. But particularly with ADHD, there is a lot of research actually that is quite shocking for people, in that actually outcomes for girls and women with ADHD is actually much more significant than it is for boys. And it is pretty devastating for boys as well if it's not picked up and managed well. But in the sense that I think, and this goes back to gender norms and gender stereotypes, whereas girls are socially, I suppose, and relationally and neurologically conditioned, you know, neurobiologically sort of wired to be much more sort of socially aware, even with neurodivergence in the sort of picture. And so girls will tend to copy and see what their peers are doing much more than boys, and can start straight going, oh, I don't know how to do that, or I'm not managing that. And whereas boys, it's more acceptable for boys to sort of express frustration outwardly, so they can be, you know, and they can get angry more acceptably, and they can, you know, boys can be more boisterous, can't they? For girls, what will happen is when they will turn it inward, so they will internalize their challenges. So there are much higher rates of, unfortunately, sort of mental health, which will be secondary to the unpicked up and unsupported ADHD. So there's much higher rates of sort of self-harm, eating disorders, suicide sort of attempts, and quite negative outcomes for girls than there are for boys, actually. I mean, again, we see that, do you see that in boys as well, that a lot of the young people that are using child and adolescent mental health services, a lot of them have underlying neurodivergence, which is really sad. And it says a lot about how we're still got a long way to go in supporting our children with difference and diversity and divergence. And so, yeah, I find that very upsetting in my sort of professional role, that I see so many that we pick up as, you know, who are 14, 15 year old, and we go, there's clearly autism here, or there's clearly ADHD here that's never been identified or flagged, or the parents have tried to raise it and been sort of told, oh, no, that's not there, or they're on a waiting list for, you know, 3 years because services can't cope with the demand. We don't have enough qualified professionals who can assess and diagnose these conditions.
It is a sad picture, but we have to raise awareness for
absolutely.
It, right? And that's
why. And I think, you know, there is starting to be, it's really interesting this thing. ADHD is becoming more understood and more, you know, it is a really complex neurodevelopmental condition. And I think people for so long have had the Daily Mail version of it, you know, in their heads, that it's children not being brought up properly, not getting enough sleep, having too much dinner, blah, 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 you know, bad parenting, all that sort of stuff. And the reality is it's a really, really challenging condition. It impacts every area of your life because it's all to do with the executive functioning part of your brain, which is crucial for success in anything, in any task, the executive functioning part of your brain. And I don't know if you've discussed this before, but obviously it's the part of your brain that's like the CEO of your brain. It's responsible for everything, for starting tasks, planning, sequencing, remembering, controlling your impulses, the self-talk. So if you've got a task to do that you don't want to do, it's that part of your brain where you go, right, I really don't want to do this, but if I sit down and get that report out of the way, then I can enjoy the rest of my day. I'll give myself a cup of tea at the end of it and a bit of cake or whatever it is. With children and adults, it's not just autism and ADHD. There are other conditions that can also, executive function can be impacted. All those parts of your, you know, that aspect of your brain is not working well. And therefore, it impacts on everything. It impacts on your ability to inhibit your impulses. So it can impact on peer relationships. It affects everything. And we still are so behind in this country, unlike America, where actually in America, some schools, they actually actively teach executive function skills to the pupils that need it. So they'll pull them out of class for maybe an hour a week or 2 hours a week, and they actually teach them the skills, because you can teach. It's like, it's a learning support, like any other children with other learning needs get, you know, accommodations and extra support for those particular learning needs. And it has, research will show that it is effective. It makes a difference. And various stuff I've done with various things to do with Hertfordshire and education, I keep saying to some of the, you know, the powers that be and some of the head teachers I get to speak to, or used to get to speak to a bit more in my old role, instead of taking these children out and putting them in internal isolation or excluding them,
yeah,
surely you'd be better put in actually pulling them out and giving that intensive work around executive function skills, problem solving, because that's the other issue that often causes difficulties with children, either, you know, coming from backgrounds maybe there's trauma and attachment issues, or, you know, from the social sort of care sort of side of things, or children with learning needs or neurodivergence. They need help with managing emotions, sensory regulation, regulating themselves when they're feeling too agitated, too excited, and they need support with executive functions. Because if we could be starting doing intensive little kind of little small groups of those kind of skills, you wouldn't need to be, you know, sending children constantly into isolation where they just sit there and have to attempt to do their own learning on their own with no support. And we think that's going to teach them something.
Oh, I just love a couple of examples of executive function, because what you're saying makes so much sense. If the children are out and out of class, use that opportunity to embed some constructive, practical skills to help them not end up back there again.
Absolutely. So there are actual programs, as I say, America's way ahead of us in this one. I think I have noticed there is a company that's just sort of set up in the UK trying to resource schools with helping them teach executive function skills. There are some books. I'm looking at my bookshelf, which is why I'm looking sideways. There's a really good book, which is called Smart But Scattered Schemes, the Executive Skills Program for Helping Teens Reach Their Potential. It's from America. Richard Guare, G-U-A-R-E, Peg Dawson and Colin Guare, G-U-A-R-E. I think he's the son of Richard. He talks about how it helped him. And it literally takes them through stuff around planning, breaking down tasks, time management. So, for example, if you have a child with ADHD, it's really, really important you make time visual. And this also would apply for autism. So that whole thing of executive function, making time real, because in your head, if you say to someone who's neurodivergent, right, you're going in 5 minutes or we're leaving in 10 minutes, someone with neurodivergence will go, oh, 10 minutes, right. So as a woman, I'd go, oh, I've got time to put the laundry on, put my makeup on and get the children out of the house all nice and calm and peaceful. But the reality is at that point, you should be stopping whatever you're doing, get yourself together, getting out the door.
Yeah. But,
so neurodivergent brains will really not understand time. And so it's really important that you actually sit with a child and break down. So, for example, going to school in the morning, if a child's persistently late, I would be looking at them, okay, so what do you need to do in the morning? What is your morning routine? What is it? You know, and I remember doing this with a young person and she was a teenage girl. So she liked to get up every morning. She needed to wash her hair. She needed to straighten her hair. She needed to put her makeup on.
Yeah.
And she was often leaving and she was late and she hadn't had time to eat breakfast and la, 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 la. And so it was actually going, like, okay, let's realistically sit down with you. How long does it take? And it was so interesting because I did it with a parent and this young person going, oh, it takes me 2 minutes to do that. Her mum was like, no, darling, that takes you 15 minutes. Yeah. And then you go, it takes me 5 minutes to do my makeup. And she'd be like, no, darling, it takes you 20. And so literally we went, okay, this is your line of how long you think it would take. And this is why you're late. And let's map what actually it takes. And then really chunk the time, you know, it's going to take you 10 minutes to go and quickly get a hot drink and a bit of toast. It's going to take you 15 minutes to do this. It's going to take you this. And what can you do the night before to help you be organized at once? So can you get your bag ready the night before? And even young people might need help with, what do I need to put in my bag and how do I even do that, depending on how impacted their executive function is, because as with anything, some people it's impacted more than others. So it literally is that kind of thing, time chunking, visual clock on the wall, so you can actually say, when that hand gets to there, that is 15 minutes. Keep it up, you know, so they can actually see that time moving. So that's just a little simple thing just about time management.
Oh, that's fantastic and so, so practical and helpful. And I bet there are parents listening to it and with the way they hear you describe executive function in a very, very practical day-to-day, I'm sure that even kind of is ringing bells, is making them think, actually, you know what, I think my son or daughter might be potentially ADHD. But there are so many myths out there, Serena, about ADHD. And can you help us bust a few of them? Can you, like, what are the worst myths?
Goodness, I'll try my best. That it's new. It's a new condition that has been made up by Big Pharma to make lots of money.
Oh, yeah.
That's, again, it's ridiculous. And there's so many things historically. I think one of the earliest, in fact, I came across something recently that was even earlier, but I forgot to write it down. But certainly one of the earliest ones was a Scottish doctor, Sir Alexander Crichton, in 1798, talking about these children that he was seeing that could get distracted by dogs barking in the classroom and these restless children. So it wasn't known by the name ADHD.
Yeah.
But there's been so many. So George Steele, he was the father of pediatrics. He's still, some of his stuff is still used, I think, in training pediatricians. Back in 1902, was talking about these children that couldn't sit still and focus and were easily distracted and could easily get into misbehavior and that kind of thing. It's gone through lots of different names, but it is the condition ADHD, but it's consistently been there for, you know, it's been there forever because it's a genetically conditioned, you know, we know that both autism and ADHD are highly genetic, sort of 75-80% higher sort of genetic weight. So it is a condition that's been in our gene pool for a very long time.
And obviously that conspiracy theory can't work, because if it wasn't, you know, if it is big pharma and a new condition, obviously there'd be no genetic link. It'd just be whatever. Yeah. But any other myth?
Yeah, and I think even the medicine, that was the way it was found, was accidentally by there was a doctor who was running it was like a children's home. It was like a facility for these difficult children and children that nobody wanted. And he gave them a drug to help them to do with, because he was doing lumbar punctures on them or something horrible, because they were trying to test what was causing some of the difficulties. But what they did notice was that it helped, that suddenly all these children who couldn't normally concentrate and behave, I hate the word, but as expected.
Just for our listeners, I'm lucky I can see Serena, but she's using inverted, air inverted commas about behave.
Behave. So he suddenly realised was all these children suddenly could say that they'd been able to sit in class and concentrate. So it was accidentally sort of discovered that a particular medication could affect concentration and behaviour. And then obviously from that, various things got developed. And again, that was back in the 30s and 40s. So I think for me, for a start, so, you know, obviously, pharmaceutical companies will make money and want to make money, and they do for every single drug that they sell through any medical thing, conditioned, don't they? But, it, you know, ADHD is, and again, it's so hard, like people keep going, oh, it's this, it's that. It is evidence-based, research-based. Now with all that we know about brain scan and brain imaging and everything, you know, it's like saying the world is still, for people who say it doesn't exist, it's like saying the world is flat. I mean, it just is like, it shows an astonishing lack of sort of
understanding and knowledge.
And there are other conditions that look like ADHD. And so are there ever misdiagnoses? Yes, certainly there will be. Not so much in this country. I think in America, potentially there has been. But in this country, we're still lagging behind. I don't actually picking up enough people that actually do genuinely have it, because we know statistically how much it is in the population. But I think, you know, the reality is it is a real condition that has very, very significant impacts. And, you know, I think, and I've been saying for years, we need to audit it. We need to be auditing it in all our health services, in our educational, you know, when schools are starting to have difficulties with people, difficulties in getting them, you know, trying to get specialist support in, because it's not being picked up because we're not auditing it. But it's in every area that the cost to society of unpicked up and unsupported ADHD is huge, because it impacts on education, impacts on then children getting sent off to specialist provision. Often outcomes for those children aren't great. Some specialist provisions are incredible and did amazing work, but sometimes children then end up coming completely out of education. They get caught up in, unfortunately, things like gangs. Particularly, you have ADHD and you're not being picked up and medicated or supported well, you will self-medicate. So a lot of children with ADHD and teenagers will be self-medicating with cannabis and other substances to manage their ADHD. And there's a whole thing about youth crime. And if we look at all the reports, there's a heartbreaking report that came out about a year ago. Oh, I can't even remember what it's called now, something like punishing abuse or something like that. And it's about young people in prison and youth offenders and institutes. And the stories of those children and their backgrounds, and a significant number of them have neurodivergence, along with very, very heartbreaking kind of childhood stories. And so we know that there's impacts on crime, there's impacts on substance misuse and addiction. And actually, there's higher rates in addiction with children with ADHD, young people with ADHD and adults. But for those who haven't been medicated with ADHD medication, actually, for those who are picked up and supported, who need the ADHD medication, not all children do with ADHD, but if it's sort of moderate to severe, certainly severe ADHD, medication is one of the most effective things to help your child then be able to use the strategies that they're given, and also reduce the risk of them ending up sort of in a negative outcomes. Higher risk of sort of risky behaviour, promiscuous behaviour, higher rates of mental health. There's higher rates of marriage breakdown when you're parenting these children. There's higher rates of, you know, you name it, it shows up everywhere, but we're not seeing it because it's not being picked up. And autism is starting to get picked up a bit more and being autism more, which is great, but we're still, even in Hertfordshire, various things I'm aware in education, it's lumped in with SEMH, so social, emotional, mental health. Well, actually, some children in that category, because perhaps they've had very difficult upbringings and very traumatic upbringings, some people are there because they have got a mental health condition, but actually that covers a lot of children with ADHD, but we're not capturing that because we're not actively screening and auditing for ADHD in any of our services.
Which is it's the wrong way around. I think there is a mentality where there's a temptation to just bury your head in the sand. It's like, oh, the more you look for it, the more you'll find it. And then you won't be able to manage it all because it'll be so huge. But actually, the current way of not auditing means that it seems like children who are not being diagnosed, the outcomes are just not positive enough for them.
No, and it impacts all of us, doesn't it? As society, we're the ones who then pay the price for that too. And it's you know, young people, well, anyone with young people, old people, adults with neurodivergence have so much to offer society. They often think and think very differently, uniquely. They see things that they notice things that other people don't. And we miss out as a society. Like, it's not like, oh, we're helping this poor disabled person, you know, out of charity. It's like, actually, no, they're equally functioning in society, who've so much to give to us, and often are, you know, if they're, you know, supported right and you find their strengths right, are often, you know, significant influence on society and for good. And it, you know, but it costs us as well, you know, it costs us, you know, long-term wise, for having to then, all the children and adults haven't been supported well, we pick up the kind of consequences for that. I mean, I think the other myth actually is, and I hear this one often, is around, oh, it's to do with diet, too much sugar, junk food, not enough sleep, too much gaming. I think any child is affected by those things, any child. And so it doesn't cause ADHD, but absolutely it wouldn't help a child with ADHD if they're having a junk food diet and not enough exercise, not enough sleep. But you could say that for any child. You know, it's like, yeah, having a child with asthma whose parents aren't managing the asthma problem. You know, any condition, you need to do the things that help it, but it doesn't cause it.
Yeah.
So I think it's, again, that's a myth. I always like, it hasn't caused it. It won't help it, but yeah, it hasn't caused it. And then the other thing is, you hear about, you know, all these people trying to diagnose people to make money. And I'm sure they may well be some disreputable companies, but actually my experience, certainly in Hertfordshire, is that a lot of the private clinicians that are diagnosing, not all of them, but a lot of them, are NHS professionals that diagnose. Half the week they're working for the NHS in Hertfordshire as part of their job. They know the services are overwhelmed. They're not going to want to increase that, you know. And it's very, you have to be careful, because it's almost slanderous, because if it's an NHS paediatrician that's doing it 3 days a week for the NHS, what we're suddenly saying that, but on the private days they're just randomly giving out these diagnoses to people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In a sense, I mean, I would always check, if parents are ever going down the private route for diagnosis, I would always be checking that the person has got sort of national health service experience, or is reputable experience, and has extensive experience of diagnosing children, and really knows their stuff for those conditions. But there is a lot of very, very well qualified professionals who are passionate about children and know what they're talking about.
And that's incredibly valuable, because honestly, just in the last few minutes when you've been explaining the myths, it's all stuff I've heard, Serena. It's all stuff I've heard parents said, educated, even teachers say. So we do need to wise up. And the one thing I want to ask you, because we're running swiftly out of time, I wanted to ask you is, it feels to me, but you know better, that there's an enhanced role for parents here. You've helped us so much get a better insight into it. The more parents ask themselves these questions, if there's recurring, and I'm using air inverted commas now, behavior issues, yeah, or lack of sleep, or ask yourself the hard questions, mm-hmm, as a parent, and reach out and get support, because it feels to me, again, correct me if I'm wrong, that a diagnosis is better than no diagnosis. Yeah. That left unchecked, it's actually more harmful to the child.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many things on it. Children want to behave well if they can. They always have. Dr. Ross Green, amazing guy. He wrote The Explosive Child. And I recommend that for any parent who's got a child that's quite hard work to manage, in the sense of quite explosive. But he, you know, he's a psychiatrist. Children always want to do well and try and please their caregivers and the sort of authority figures in their life. So when they're not doing that, it's because they can't. They're missing skills, or there's something happening in their life that's too overwhelming. A diagnosis is better than a label of a naughty, disruptive child, or a pain at the backside, or whatever else names children you get called, the clown, the class clown. The amount of teachers I've worked with, because I've done a lot of teacher training, training social workers in Hertfordshire, the amount of time teachers have come up to me and gone, oh my gosh. Because I always say, if it's children, you either your heart sinks when they walk in your room and they're like, oh my gosh, they're going to destroy the classroom. They're such hard work. They never sit still. They can't concentrate, can't focus. Or the ones that you're like, oh, their heads in the clouds. They're such daydreamers. They're away with the fairies. Those are flags to me of ADHD, either inattentive ADHD, because obviously there's subtypes, inattentive daydreamy type presentation is often ADHD. And the ones that are really hard to sit still, fidgety, can't listen to instructions is the other kind. And it still amazes me that it still gets missed so much. And then the label of being the naughty, disruptive, difficult child is far more damaging than actually an accurate one. And once you understand the condition, it makes so much more sense. And there's so many things you can do. There's loads of brilliant courses in Hertfordshire being run by lots of different parent-led charities. There's loads of books, there's loads of training. There is a lot of stuff as a parent you can do. But the reality is that often the parents themselves are struggling with those conditions themselves, and they need help themselves with executive functioning and keeping themselves calm, because we're trying to model that and support our children with learning to react calmly and think through options. So the amount of times there's so many things I could say. I have to come back another time.
I'm already thinking that. I was just thinking, I'm so sorry we don't have more time, because I have so many questions. But please finish your thoughts, Serena.
Yeah, well, there's so many things you can do to help your child. I mean, one of the things is often I'll say, oh, they never listen. Children literally never listen. And the reality is, what we know is they actually, sometimes they literally generally haven't heard. They just generally have not heard. It's to do with the way the brain processes that information. Sometimes they might have got a bit of what you said, but you've put way too much information in there and they've lost it. They've only got a fraction of it. Occasionally, they may be so with that impulse, they're so focused on whatever they're doing, their impulse is so strong, because that impulsivity of ADHD is that they want to carry on doing whatever they're doing. So they actually physically find it really hard to stop to attend to what you're asking them to do. And obviously, there are times when children deliberately choose not to do what they're asked to do. But I would check with I'd always used to go to my son, what have I just asked you to do? Like nicely, not like, what are you supposed to be doing? But what are you asking, you know, what are you supposed to do? And the amount of times he'd look at me genuinely blank faced, and I'd be like, okay, I genuinely thought he was ignoring me, but he really didn't get it. Or he'd look at me and say something like, was it something to do with my shoes? And he literally wouldn't. So just check back, start checking. Yeah. Have they understood what you said? And cut down the information you put in a sentence. They can't cope with, come downstairs now, get your coat on, put your shoes and let's go. Way too much information with a child with neurodivergence issues. It's call the name of the child, get their attention, shoes, now, bag, brilliant. Now. You break brilliant. It right down. Really simple instructions.
Brilliant. Lovely tip. And it means you go from whatever kitchen table to on the way to school in a lot less time, I'd imagine.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, there are lots of things out there. So get involved, get connected to all the parent support groups, because there are a lot of parents who kind of, you can learn from them. That's what we did. We had to, yeah.
So Serena, I haven't even begun to milk your expertise, but I'd love to have you back, because that was just so fantastic to hear your insight. And I know that'll be incredibly valuable, not just for our ADHD community, but for, you know, for the wider community, because the more we all understand and have empathy, first and foremost, for the challenges of our ADHD and autism community, the better we're all going to kind of just fly through school and get the most out of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks a million.
As we've mentioned, if you or someone you know is struggling with these issues, please consider seeking support from a mental health professional or a helpline, such as the Samaritans, who can be reached on 116 123. November is Novel Writing Month, where the challenge is to start and finish writing a novel within the month. Neil caught up with Nikki Valance, who talks about her journey to becoming a published author and gives some helpful advice to anyone who feels they want to write a book.
Hello and welcome to The Parent Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Neil Roger. And did you know this month is Novel Writing Month? So as a result, we're joined by Nikki Valance. Now, Nikki is a Hertfordshire-based writer and coach who, as well as being a published novelist with her debut book Pivotal, also works with others to unlock their writing talents. Nikki, thank you so much for joining us. Can you share a little bit about your own background and your own journey towards becoming a novelist?
Yes, of course. I didn't start out a career as a writer or a creative career at all. I was working in recruitment for a number of years, for 20 odd years. And so it wasn't really until my 40s that I actually started seriously writing. And writing a novel isn't an overnight thing. it took a number of years to get there, but it was something that I picked up later on. So at the time when I started, I had young children. So I'd like to say to anybody, if you fancy writing a novel, go for it. The fact that you have other things going on shouldn't be the reason to stop you from doing it.
Because I know that you had a full busy career, you were a mum. I think you mentioned that you were getting some coaching and stuff like that. So at what point did you realise that you actually wanted to give it a go? And if you could describe it, like, what was the switch between, I kind of fancy that, I talk about it after a few glasses of wine, it's something I've always not minded the idea of. When did you actually start the process of saying, right, I'm going to give this a go?
So writing had always been part of my life from as a child. I used to write poetry. I wrote a diary when I was a teenager for pretty much every day for 7 years. I wrote songs, but I didn't really ever think it was going to be the thing that I did as a job. So like most people, it got pushed to the side and I didn't really give it any time. I didn't have any time. I didn't think I had any time to put to it. But I was working as a coach and I had a coach myself and I wanted to focus on some goals that were sensible. You know, I had a career, I wanted to make sure I did that well. I wanted to look after myself and I had a health and fitness goal. And she suggested that it's really a good idea to have something to counterbalance that, because otherwise you can get very, very focused on, you know, an imbalanced kind of life. So I said, well, I don't know. I think a third goal might be around creativity or something. And she said, fine, well, it's up to you. It doesn't have to be particularly smart or anything. It's your choice. So we came back after that first week and I said, you know what? I think I've decided. I think it's going to be writing a book. And she said, well, that's really interesting. Where's that come from? And I said, well, I kind of always thought I might do it, but I think I'm going to really give it a go this time. So she said, well, that's great. So then the next week I came back to her and said, you're not going to believe this. I've had an amazing idea for a story and I'm actually not just going to write it. I'm going to make sure it gets published. I'm going to be an author. So very quickly, what I think happened was something that was buried deep came to the surface. And then as soon as it was in front of me, I thought, well, I've got to do this thing.
So this is your debut novel, I guess you're talking about. This is Pivotal, right? So Pivotal was published. So, okay, in that case, what was the idea for Pivotal and did it stay the same all the way through? Or, you know, what's it, the process actually like of getting your idea onto paper and getting started?
Well, it started really quickly because I had a fully formed overarching story and the premise of the book came to me literally in a moment with the four main characters and pretty much they were fully formed as well. So the process is tricky because you've got to get everything that's in your head onto paper. And all I did initially was I just wrote what was in there. And for the first sort of quarter of the book, I found it really easy because it just all came out. And then I'm going to be really honest, the middle was really tricky because they often say the middle is difficult because you've got to try and connect the beginning and the end, which most people know quite clearly, but they don't know what the middle is about. So partly in terms of writing, it was difficult, but also because life gets in the way and because you start to maybe think, oh, can I really do this? And you maybe doubt yourself. So there were quite a lot of months, sometimes years, where I didn't really write anything. But I knew that I was going to finish it. I knew it was important. And actually, answering your other question, yes, it's pretty much as I thought it would be, which is unusual. I think often you think a book will be a certain way. And then when you start to look at it and edit it, it changes. I did do in total 17 edits. So it's 17 versions of the book. But the majority of the core of the idea and of those main characters stayed from the beginning.
Okay, so for those who don't know, Pivotal, so by the way, is available from all good bookshops and some rubbish ones as well. Like, what's Pivotal about, okay, for anyone who doesn't know?
So Pivotal is a story of four women in their 40s who are seemingly unconnected, who all have their lives disrupted by a mysterious bequest. And unfortunately for them, and probably predictably for us, it's not as simple as just being given some money. There are some strings attached. So throughout the book, we're discovering who they are, what makes them tick, how they've come to where they are in their lives, and the decisions they've made along the way that make them who they are. And then that final decision, do they say yes? Do they say no? And are they connected?
Oh, sounds amazing. Right. So tell me this then. So, you know, you spend a long time, you've been creative all your life, really. What's that moment like when you get handed a copy of Pivotal and you're a published author? Because that's the change, right? What does that feel like?
Pretty amazing. I actually remember the day very clearly. Before publication day, the author gets their hands on some copies for themselves if they want to sell them and stuff. And so a box or two arrived on the doorstep, and then you open the box really carefully because you don't want to spoil the books inside. And then you take one out and you turn it over, and it's kind of a bit surreal, really. In fact, I don't even think it's really properly sunk in now. But I guess over time, your brain shifts and you have to recognise that you have written a book. It's very easy to start comparing yourself to all the people who've sold hundreds of thousands of copies, because obviously as a first-time novelist, you may not do that. But you have to accept it. You have done it. And then you've got to do it again. If you want to be a novelist, you've got to write another one. So
so are you now writing another one?
I am. I'm probably about a third of the way through my second novel. And they're standalone. They're not connected to each other. I've got probably ideas, outlines for at least three other, really solid outlines for three others. So it's almost a case of I've got to get one finished to be able to get on with the other one. And the brain does this thing to you where it tricks you into saying, oh, go and do some research for that thing over there. That's really interesting. And you have to say, no, get on with it. Write the one you've got in front of you. Because it's quite hard work. So you have to kind of stick with it.
Yeah. And I can imagine there's a bit of a challenge of, it's a really creative pursuit and it's very ideas focused, but there also has to be a kind of almost like a process and a sort of rigid, right? I'm going to do 2 hours now, then I'm going to do my research and all this kind of stuff.
Yes, you have to have a routine. My routine is I choose when I'm going to be focusing on my book and I choose when I'm going to be focusing on my other creative projects, of which the podcast I do is one. And so when I'm writing, I have a regular time when I write. In fact, I may not write that much, but I commit to being at my desk for a couple of hours a day during that period. And sometimes it really flows and you lose track of time and you might do more than 2 hours. And other times it's a really hard slog and you just have to keep going. One piece of advice I was given, and I definitely would give this to anybody else, is it's very easy to keep looking back and trying to make the stuff you've already written better. But you absolutely need to keep looking forward and finish your first rough draft, because otherwise you'll never finish if you don't.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. So look, it sounds like it's been something that you're delighted to have done. So with this being Novel Writing Month, I guess this is a great opportunity for aspiring writers to, you know, dive into the world of storytelling and kind of finally have a go for themselves. Is that something you'd recommend people having a go at?
I've never done novel writing in the structured, what they call it, NaNoWriMo, I think, which is Novel Writing Month. I think it shortens to that. I've never done it that way because it's never quite coincided with the time when I'm really driving the book. I know lots of people who've done it. What's really good about it is you haven't got time to look back. You've got to get through that work. You're basically submitting words, you know, every day, and you're trying to get to a finished novel. So you have to just go for it. And the people who've done it have said what it did for them is it got that difficult, oh, how am I going to get it all out part of the process done really quickly. And then they could take some time to review what they'd written and polish it and add to it and so on. So I think if you've got something that you've been thinking about and you've got some time in November, I would definitely go for it, because all it will mean is you're a bit further forward to your dream of finishing something and becoming a writer. So, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And it's almost like you don't have the luxury of worrying too much about what's gone before. You have to crack on and do the right thing.
Yeah,
that's interesting. All right, so changing tack then, Nikki, what's your own favourite novel? And I know that's a very tricky question. I'm sure it changes day to day, week to week. But is there one you always go back to, or one that's, I don't know, particularly well written, or is there, you know, what's your own pick? If you can only read one again.
You're so right. It's so difficult. My answer actually is almost always consistently Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, because I remember reading it when I was a teenager. I have reread it. I've watched most of the adaptations on television, and it just has so much atmosphere. The characters are really strong. The mystery is really strong. I love a book with a mystery, not necessarily a murder mystery, but just something that you're trying to uncover as you're reading. And it has all of those elements in it. She was a phenomenal writer. I mean, lots of her other stories, even short stories she's written, have gone on to have films made of them and so on. So, yeah, it has to be that one. So it's not, I think it's not particularly, it's a classic, obviously, but it's not particularly difficult to read. It's not sort of highbrow or literary in that sense, but it definitely stands the test of time. Everyone who reads it. In fact, I think it's even read for maybe A-level or... It's definitely on the syllabus somewhere, I think. But yeah, that's my favourite.
It's a fantastic novel. And yeah, it definitely is accessible because amazingly, I'm delighted you chose that one because to sound clever, it's actually one I've read. So I'm delighted about it. Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's an amazing book. Absolutely amazing book. Okay, so Nikki, we talked a bit on the Parents Show previously about the importance of kids getting into the world of books and learning almost the kind of magic of literature. Is that something you're an advocate for? And, you know, do you think it's quite important that families get together and, you know, share reading experiences and share the same joys of books?
The short answer is yes, yes, yes. I don't know. My children are a little bit older now, but I don't know how easy it is for people to do that. But if they can make time for it, I would definitely recommend it. I read to both my children, they're sort of 6 years apart, so I was able to do it separately for both of them from when they were babies. And I got to the point where I was reading them some of my favourite books that I read probably up to about the age of 11. So series like for my son, I read all of the Narnia books to him. He could already read, but I read them out loud to him. And with my daughter, I think we were reading The Naughtiest Girl in School or... I mean, they were already reading things like Harry Potter themselves, but I carried on reading until they said, look, don't do it anymore, Mum. But no, we definitely had it as part of our routine. And I even used to sing to them every night as well. So it was just, it was a lovely time. And they both are prolific readers. They both love books now, which maybe amongst their peers, perhaps they are uncommon in that they do that. But my daughter definitely buys books to switch off. When she's at university, she's studying, but she still has moments when she says, oh, I just want to read today, you know, just because I need to de-stress. So I think absolutely it's a fundamental skill we all need to have anyway, and it's the bedrock of all education. So if you can start early and get them loving reading, then, you know, you're setting them up for success.
I think that's right. It really kind of fires up their little imaginations, doesn't it? As a funny story, a friend told me he's got two young twins and they were always reading the same stories, reading their favourites. And then one day with a load of family around, one of the twins, who's 2.5 years old, picked up one of the books and opened it and essentially started reciting the book out loud. And the family's looking over going, oh my God, she's reading it. But of course she wasn't. She just knew the story and knew which bit the pages were. But, you know, there's a hushed silence as they thought they had a genius in the camp.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, and I totally agree. I remember getting read to when I was a kid, and it's something I absolutely love doing with my son now. And I think it does start that kind of lifelong learning journey. I think the downside is I recommended my young nephews to read the Box of Delights one Christmas, and they handed it back to me a little bit kind of nonplussed and said, it's just a bit weird. And I reread it and I was like, okay, yeah, I get that. Maybe, you know, you remember stuff slightly differently, I think.
Yeah, there are definitely some books I went back to. There's a book called Gobelino, The Witch's Cat, and it's kind of a bit like Black Beauty in that the cat has different chapters in different places. He's always trying to get away from the witch who has an allergy to cats. But the thing is, I didn't realise when I reread it how dated the language was, how actually some of the societal norms had shifted so much that it was like, oh, I don't know whether we would want to say that now.
Yeah.
But the concept was brilliant. And he was always trying to find a new home, find a new family that did love him because the witch had to have him, but didn't really want him. So yeah, I think what I would sometimes do is maybe as I was reading out loud to my children, it's got to change the language a little bit so that it sort of fitted with what they were expecting.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. So look, Nikki, we're starting to run out of time now, but the question I have to ask, because otherwise I can imagine people shouting at their radio at this point. So look, tricky one, I imagine, but What practical advice would you give anyone listening who's always fancied trying to start on a novel?
Okay. If you haven't got any ideas at all and you fancy doing it, just take out a notebook every day and write whatever's in your head. Not to write a story, but just to get the exercise, the muscle of writing. If you have got an idea, capture what you've got as your idea in note form. Just get it down somewhere, either, you know, type it out or write it down. And then I would say, this is what I did, start writing. I know it sounds really glib, but actually, if you start, what will happen is the imagination will and the creativity will flow as you're writing. And you may find, as you said earlier, that it changes into something else completely, but that's fine. But unless you actually start getting it out of your head in some form, then it's not ever going to happen. So you've got to start. And in terms of other practical advice, one other thing is don't worry about the quality. The first draft is for you only, for your eyes only. No one else is going to see it. So it doesn't really matter how good or otherwise it is. Don't judge it until you've actually got it out.
That makes complete sense. And look, Nikki, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time and joining us here on The Parent Show. If people want to find out more about your work and listen to your podcast, find out what you're up to in your coaching, where can they go?
So it's all on my website, which is nikkivallance.com. So NikkiVallance. And you can find the podcast there, all the previous season's episodes. You can find details of my coaching services and everything about my book. And you can even buy a signed copy from me. You can't get those from the bookshop. So
brilliant. Nikki, thank you so much. And please do come back on when the next one's published.
I will do. No worries.
Lovely. Thank you so much for joining us, Nikki. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.